Paper one. Right at the beginning. Old single column, page 21. Which is 7 times 3, which is the expression of our super universe. I think everyone knows where we're about to journey. We probably ought to just jump in. I guess we've got a reader queuing up. I think the one thing that I'd like everyone to kind of just have in mind, these first three paragraphs, we're going to pay a little extra attention to them, and you'll understand why when we get there. We won't let them blow by as easily as we might others, because it's important to really take note of how did they decide to start. Yeah, they've got all of the technical issues out of the way now with the forward. How did they decide to start? You know, everyone knows how a novelist spends a lot of time thinking about, you know, what's that first paragraph going to be? What's that first sentence going to be? How am I going to start the reader? So this obviously is going to be no different. They would have given this a lot of consideration. And the divine counselor who's writing this, how to begin the process. So let's see where he goes.
Part 1, the central and super universes. Paper 1, the universal father. The universal father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings. First, think of God as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. The truth about the Universal Father had begun to dawn upon mankind when the prophet said, "You, God, are alone. There is none beside you. You have created the heaven and the heaven of heavens with all their hosts. You preserve and control them." By the sons of God were the universes made. The Creator covers himself with light as with a garment and stretches out the heavens as a curtain. Only the concept of the Universal Father, one God in the place of many gods, enabled mortal man to comprehend the Father as divine creator and infinite controller.
Okay. So now just step back and think about it. You know, you're a brand new reader, and all the little details aside, what's obviously the very first thing he's putting forward? He's saying, okay, if you've had any sort of a monotheistic concept of God, behind that monotheistic concept of God is this fact, the Universal Father. So the first thing that he's doing is trying to link that that individual, no matter how limited their concept might be, if it's, you know, like he's stressing at the end, if it is has any measure of solid monotheistic quality to it, isn't just a mishmash of stuff, and he's saying what you want to firmly anchor onto the threads of truth that you've grabbed hold of there, with that notion of a one God, is this expression of personalized deity, the Universal Father. So, not surprising, you know, it's the title of the paper. That would be the very first thing. But, you know, you could imagine other ways to get at it. But to do that, he does that first. And notice how he does it. We're not going to, unpack every one of the Bible quotes in the book. But every once in a while, I might highlight one. And I definitely want to highlight this one. I think it was even you a while back, you know, that read that and said, so who is this prophet? And remember how at the end of the foreword, they were talking about how they were going to use human source works. You know, and the Bible is a great example of that. And so a very challenging and instructive example of what we were talking about, you know, conceptually, theoretically back there, is right here. So, you know, look what you have. You have four sentences in quotes, in quotation marks. And it's prefaced by "when the prophet said," not "when prophets said." It says "when the prophet said." And so you're thinking, you know, in the normal mode of humans relating to a written work, you're going, okay, you know, whoever said this, is this one person, you know, and they said these four sentences or something like them. Maybe they said them in Aramaic and this has been translated into English, but like the Bible, but apparently it's, you know, one person. Well, if you know the Bible, you know, so there's the next thing. Okay, if you're a brand new reader and you don't know the Bible, maybe you just get that bit about the monotheism and tied to Universal Father. But if you've, you know the Bible at all, you'll go, wait a minute, I know what they're referencing here. The prophet here is Nehemiah, okay? As in, you know, right after the exile, Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, so those first two sentences are tied to, you know, to Nehemiah. You know, if you can find Psalms in the Bible, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms. Okay? All right, before Psalms and Proverbs. Okay. Okay, so you know, you get that, and you go, not only do I know that's from Nehemiah, but I remember what's going on there. That's right towards the beginning of a very beautiful extended psalm-like prayer that's in Nehemiah. And you probably just guessed, you know, I said the first two sentences and I just stressed the psalm-like. You know, guess what those other two sentences are. Are those two more sentences in Nehemiah? Like it, a fact finder would be thinking? No. The third sentence is from the 33rd Psalm. And the fourth sentence is from the 104th Psalm. Okay. So this is a great example, just that part of it, you know, to start with, of how they use human source works, be it Bible or otherwise. Okay. The consciousness of Nehemiah had a truth in it. And the truth of that consciousness is expressed, can be expressed and used, not unmodified, but it can be parsed, and it can, you can say some of that consciousness in a nice pithy fashion with this sentence out of the 33rd Psalm and this sentence out of the 104th Psalm, and you put it all together, and not in fact did Nehemiah say. You know, or you could speculate, maybe sometime when it wasn't recorded, you know, he actually said those two sentences from those two psalms at the same time or something. Yeah, okay, you can go off on that tangent, but that's pointless. You know, you're missing the whole point. The point is not to rationalize it factually. The point is to recognize it truth. What's being quoted, like I said, they're not quoting fact or quoting truth. There's a truth in Nehemiah's consciousness, and it's being quoted here. And the words of him, or, you know, processed him, who knows, you know, how it all went through until you got, you know, the book of Nehemiah as we have it today. But, and a couple of sentences from Psalms. Okay. Now, just one other little specific thing, let's burrow in a little bit. That sentence from the 33rd Psalm, where it says, "By the sons of God were the universes made." Okay, now you're, you know, if you're a Urantia book, you're going, whoa, there's something in the Bible that has universes in the plural and sons? The word son in the, you know, in the plural? No. Okay, if you go to the 33rd Psalm, what does that sentence say? That in the 33rd Psalm, that sentence says, "By the word of God were the heavens made." Okay? Okay, by the word of God were the heavens made. What's the truth of that sentence? You know, when you know the true cosmos. Okay, the word God. There's the thought God, that's the universal Father. Who's the word God? The eternal Son. Okay. And, okay, not heavens, more precisely, you know, factually, literally, it's universes. Okay, and if you're going to say universes, remember we're talking about the local universes. Okay, we're not talking about the eternal Son. We're talking about the Creator Sons. Yeah, the word downstep to the local universe level. Okay, so it's not the Son. It's the Sons, the Creator Sons in the local universes. Okay, that's just those two little modifications of that sentence from the 33rd Psalm. You've got the full beauty of the truth of it, and you know, it's not leading you astray relative to the actual cosmos. You know, where you're thinking in some simplistic, you know, kind of mystical terms, the heavens. No, there's literally, you know, the universe and the universe of universes. It's a very literal place, nothing mystical. Okay, and there's suns that are in charge of each of those universes. So right off the bat, they're wanting you to get a you know, more than just the spirit from the Bible, you know, which, you know, humans have had to try to really do. Those who have begun to recognize that, you know, there's going to be some historical issues with the Bible. I can't read it literally. You know, but I can step back and try to somehow embrace the spirit in it, and there's going to be a truth in that spirit of it. And so people have developed techniques of backing off, you know, of the specificity, you know, and seeing the truth that flows through the Bible in spite of all the issues about its historical creation. That's not the Urantia Book. The Urantia Book can be taken literally. It's written precisely, every word. It not only has the full spirit in it, but it has the precision too. Yeah. And that is a complete non sequitur in all of human history. Never before in human history has there been a book that you could pick up, that you could challenge with complete literal specificity. You know, why did they use this word in this sentence and not in that sentence? You know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, why is this word plural, and you know, on and on, you know, and that's a, because that's such uncharted territory in human history, it's poorly appreciated by new readers of the Urantia Book. They're just not expecting that you can challenge it like that. I dare you to be logical. You know, they're going, I'll bet you can give me something spiritual inspiration. They'll give it that much. You know, maybe even without even reading it, you know, if they're very, very open to sort of everything that comes along. But, you know, to take on that next challenge. You know, and that, of course, was behind the intensity that we just went through in the foreword. It's like, why are you plotting? Well, it's like, because it's all there. I mean, each one of these sentences is a vast, you know, domain condensed into one sentence. It's very dense, and it's very precise, and it's very challenging. And you know, we're moving into a little bit more open waters now. But whether or not the book is a little bit more straightforward to read or not, it's still very precise. And they're not going to use the Bible in a way that will, can really do nothing but lead you off into error. If there's no way to use it except that it would lead you off in error, then they're not going to use it. You know another person that used the Hebrew Scriptures the exact same way. That person's name was Jesus, Joshua ben Joseph. You know, he didn't stand before crowds and start on page one of the Hebrew Scriptures and just read the entire thing. You know, he very carefully selected passages, you know, that he could basically just quote directly and have it not get them off into difficult a tangent. The revelators here now are taking it the next notch. It's like, we're basically never going to quote it directly. because we want you to get, you know, we're not just here as a spiritual uplifter like Jesus was. We're here to do a lot more than that. We're here to give you precision of a precise cosmos. And so we need to, you know, unhesitatingly, remember how they use that word? Modify the Bible passages as they need to be modified in order for them to be coordinated essential knowledge. Okay. So there's that. And then there's one also, you know, we all know there's one other thing in there for the more advanced reader. The very first two sentences. Universal Father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings. First think of God as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. Okay, and we all know that's when you're ready to do more than just, you know, that monotheistic God thing you have. Well, just bond that solidity to the Universal Father, and you know, and then let's move from there. Okay, when you're ready to do more than just that simple first step, you're ready to recognize that God the Father and the Universal Father are not synonyms. The Universal Father is one facet of God the Father. The facet that has the volitional circuit, you know, the facet that, you know, in which your personality is encircuited. That's the Universal Father, but there's five other facets. One of those facets is called the first source. One of those facets is called the first center. So those are the other two in that first sentence. So think of that first sentence. They say, grab a hold of the Universal Father. Just picture it. See, now picture it in the infinite eternal ellipse. Grab a hold of the Universal Father. There you are. In the third functional level domain. And that first sentence, you know, kind of is sort of an afterthought in that first sentence. They're saying, now, behind the Universal Father, there's a couple of facets. Behind the Universal Father is the first source and the first center. That's the roots of the Universal Father. And then they go to the second sentence. They're saying, now, you know, on your side, because remember, you're being engaged here in the fifth level domain, on your side, as you move from the Universal Father, first think of God as a, you know, first think of Him as a creator and as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. Okay? And now, not only, now, we've taken it to the next notch. You know, notice it's all in general. You know, a controller, you know, a creator, a controller, a, you know, an infinite upholder. Okay, not only is he a creator, he's the universal creator. Not only is he a controller, he's the universal controller. And he's literally the infinite upholder. Now, why did they, you know, they didn't put universal in lowercase u on the other two. Why didn't they just say, you know, a creator, then a controller, and lastly an upholder? Why did they stick infinite on there? Because even in speaking in general terms, not getting you to try to, you know, understand these other proper designations and all that right up front here in the first two sentences, but if they just said upholder, that would immediately start leading you astray. Because he's only the infinite upholder. Only the infinite upholder. He's not the absolute upholder. He's not the absentite upholder. And he's not the finite upholder. Only at the infinite level is he the upholder. Okay? So, you know, that's why that's very, you know, precisely put in there. And you'll see them immediately playing off of that some more, you know, in the way they word sentences. Not letting a sentence be too pablum, you know, that it sort of is fundamentally erroneous. It's just going to inexorably lead everyone astray. They won't do that. They'll always put in something that it's easy for someone who's not recognizing yet to go past and not stumble over, but as soon as you start noticing the more of the words, you know, you're not going to go, wait a minute, there's a sentence that says that he's just the upholder. No. All right. So that's the most one we wanted to belabor the most, that very first paragraph. So that's how they started. They started you off with a really complexified Bible quote a reference to monotheism, and a delightful little foretaste of the infinite eternal ellipse, all in the first paragraph.
Before we go on, can you tell me the Bible quote for the next sentence? The Creator covers himself with light.
Oh, that's the 104th Psalm. Both of those are right towards the beginning of those two psalms. If you just start reading those two psalms, you'll immediately run across them. And again, they pick the words. You know, so sometimes you can find a translation that'll use one of those specific words. Other translations won't. You know what I mean? Yeah, but they're all basically there. All right.
The myriads of planetary systems were all made to be eventually inhabited by the many different types of intelligent creatures. Beings who could know God, receive the divine affection, and love him in return. The universe of universes is the work of God and the dwelling place of his diverse creatures. God created the heavens and formed the earth. He established the universe and created this world not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited.
That last one, you know, just a little bit of tweaking of Isaiah, because Isaiah's got a nice little thing about this to be inhabited. You know, he's got that line in there, and that's the real meat of what they want to grab a hold of there and uplift. Okay, so think about this second sentence. They've anchored a God notion, and then they really open things up. Okay, what do they tell you in this next sentence? You know, think of all the people on the planet who aren't in this space. The myriads of planetary systems. So the very first thing is, there are all kinds of planetary systems. And they were all made to be eventually inhabited. Radical statement. No humans ever thought that. Not only that, by many different types of intelligent creatures. You know, we're really getting into sci-fi space. Okay. But even sci-fi is not, you know, there at the beginning. I mean, the basic assumption man has is you got a big randomly formed universe full of spheres of dirt. And for mysterious reasons that no one is quite able to even hand wave, you know, well on, some of them have life on them. So you start with the initial assumption, well, there's none of them inhabited because there's no purpose behind them. It's just balls of dirt that fell together. But through some magical, mystical mechanism, be you scientist or religionist, some of them got life on them. And so there's, you know, and because there's so many, many galaxies, you multiply a microscopic probability times this huge number, and you're going to get some, you know, non-negligible number of inhabited worlds. No, I mean, so that's 180 degrees false. Now, the only reason that any, you know, ball of dirt exists is so that creatures have a place to stand. And the question is, at this point in the universe, it may be the case that it hasn't fully evolved to completion. There may be balls of dirt that aren't even really balls of dirt. They're just a big ball of gas. You know, and no one can stand on them. And so they're kind of a non sequitur right now. But in the bigger picture, you know, when all is said and done, there's just going to be places for creatures to stand, because that's the only reason that matter, you know, in terms of just a big ball of dirt, exists. When you go to Havona, there aren't, you know, uninhabited worlds in Havona. There aren't meteors. There aren't gas giants. There aren't, you know. Every single one of those billion worlds is inhabited, and there is no billion and one world. And that's the pattern universe. So right off the bat, you know, just think about how much is there. How much mind-stretching statement is really being put in just that simple sentence. Those of us who have read the book for a long time, or maybe who, you know, love science fiction, aren't so blown away by that. But that is just an extremely radical sentence. In terms of human history. And then, you know, they purposely had a heavens line. You know, we talked about that. You know, they want to turn that into the universe of universes. So they do that in the second paragraph. And But notice too, you know, what else they threw in there. Not only do you have that universe of universes, but those creatures, they're beings who could know God, receive the divine affection, and love him in return. Not only was everything created to be inhabited, but this is how it's going to be inhabited. Is it going to be inhabited by beings who can know God? Or even beings who will know God? No, it's beings who could know God. You could know God if you choose. So could you. But you're not designed that way. It's not that you just automatically can know God. And it's not even a definitive, you know, you may not know God now, but you will. No, that's not a given either. It's not will or can, it's could. And only could. Because that last step, the Universal Father divested himself of. He took out that step of making it can or definitive will and put that in you. He took it out of himself and put that step in you. He gave you personality and free will. And that's why it's could. So the universe of universes is the work of God and the dwelling place of his diverse creatures. Okay, and then bringing in that Bible quote again. So you've got this next paragraph. And you know, as a new reader, you leave that with, okay, wow, the universe was created to be inhabited, and it is multitudinously inhabited because that's why it was created. And so there's going to be inhabited planets everywhere I look. It's going to be the exception that I can find one that isn't. I mean, you know, people wonder, you know, man, if our telescopes get good enough, you suppose we'll get lucky enough to see a solar system that has an inhabited world? No, you'll be extremely lucky to find one that isn't inhabited. Because that means it's just a here today, gone tomorrow phenomenon that has no place in eternity. I mean, if it's going to be around for any length of time, it's because it's going to be inhabited. Yeah. Eternity is not going to be supporting a bunch of dead weight planets. Yeah. It's just a completely different picture of the universe that they're trying to paint right up front. Okay, how about the third paragraph?
The enlightened worlds all recognize and worship the Universal Father, the eternal maker and infinite upholder of all creation. The will creatures of universe upon universe have embarked upon the long, long paradise journey, the fascinating struggle of the eternal adventure of attaining God the Father. The transcendent goal of the children of time is to find the eternal God, to comprehend the divine nature, to recognize the Universal Father. God-knowing creatures have only one supreme ambition, just one consuming desire, and that is to become as they are in their spheres, like him as he is in his paradise perfection of personality and in his universal sphere of righteous supremacy. From the Universal Father who inhabits eternity, there has gone forth the supreme mandate, "Be you perfect even as I am perfect." And in love and mercy, the messengers of paradise have carried this divine exhortation down through the ages and out through the universes, even to such lowly animal origin creatures as the human races of Urantia.
Okay. Notice one little thing right up front in that first sentence. There's two things in that first sentence. Yeah. The enlightened worlds all recognize and worship the Universal Father. Flip that one around. If you don't recognize the Universal Father, are you enlightened?
No.
But besides that little between the lines thing there, notice, worship the Universal Father, and then the parenthetical, the eternal maker and the infinite upholder. He's not the temporal maker, and he's not the finite upholder. He's the eternal maker. And the infinite upholder only. He's divested himself of everything below eternity and infinity. You know, and when he engages you in that personality circuit, even if we're talking about that facet of God the Father, you notice they mentioned God the Father there too. I mean, even as the universal Father, He's reaching out and encircling you from infinity and eternity. He's not coming down into space with you, not into time with you. That linkage is from infinity and eternity. When we look at it in a time viewpoint, you know, we look this way to infinity, we look this way to eternity. But that's kind of just, you know, when we're thinking in the individuality viewpoint. I mean, this circuit of the Father is all up there. You know, it's not like you go around here and you get to the finite upholder or something, like you're coming down from, you know, it's all up at that high level, that circuit. All right, so there's that. Stressing it again. I mean, amazing. See, in three paragraphs, you have infinite upholder. It's very interesting to notice that. Okay, some other things. Okay, now, in terms of being a new reader, I'm reading this, and I see blazoned right up front here, be you perfect, even as I am perfect. Yeah. And, you know, you may even, it says it that way. It doesn't say, be you perfect even as the Father in heaven is perfect. It's said in a nice, in a very personal way. But be you perfect even as I am perfect. So if I'm coming away from this sentence as a discerning new reader, I'm noticing, so right up front they're telling me that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. The purpose of life is this. I was wondering about the meaning of life, but I see they didn't answer that question first. You know, and if I'm a little discerning and I have contemplated the difference between value and meaning, I even noticed that they didn't answer the question, what's the value of life? This is clearly about the purpose of the whole thing. Purpose of life is its perfectibility. And if I'm a longer-term reader and I'm starting to notice some of the details, I notice right before that it has some interesting modifying adjectives. So God-knowing creatures have only one supreme ambition. They're bringing that in, you know. And if I've read the foreword, that supreme is a technical word. So what are they telling me there? They mentioned righteous supremacy, and then right before they said, "Be you perfect," they said, "From the universal Father who inhabits eternity, there has gone forth the supreme mandate." Well, wait a minute. If the Father is only up there at infinity, can He only issue infinite mandates? Yeah. So technically, this mandate got downstepped to the supreme level and put out there. And what's that downstepped expression of the universal Father down to the supreme level? The supreme being. You see, so technically, that's where that supreme mandate comes from. And the supreme being is following an ultimate mandate. You know, and the ultimate one is following an absolute mandate. You know, and the absolute one is following an infinite mandate. This has gotten downstepped. Okay. See, so again, they're throwing that in so that you can begin to not think about it magically. The infinite Father needs these adjutants to bring it down to you directly. You know. He doesn't issue supreme-like mandates. That would require Him to have a consciousness of space and time, you know, at least in some sort of total sense at the supreme level. But He doesn't have that. He's infinitely transcendent of such a consciousness. Yeah. And then they even throw in right at the very end, for those who know that evolution stuff is just a bunch of bunk and no religionist could believe in anything like that, this little thing they throw in there. You know, it's getting really poetic, and in the midst of that poetry, even to such lowly animal origin creatures. as the human races of your nation. It even has the word races in it.
Why don't all the planets give birth like we did with evolution for the animal origin?
Right. Right. See, so obviously it's not, they're not saying animal origin because somehow we're animal origin and others aren't. You know, why are they saying animal origin there? It's because this challenge that so many religionists that are open enough to start reading this book, you know, have really thought that that's a whole, you know, that there's no place for the notion of evolution from animals when you're thinking about God and Him as your creator. Well, yeah, there's got to be something like that because He's only your eternal maker. You know, and I exist in time. So He may snap His fingers at infinity and eternity, but that finger snap has got to get downstepped into space and time. And that finger snap, when it's downstepped into space and time, is going to get stretched out through space and through time. You know, evolution is creativity in time. Creativity in time. Right? See, all of that's in there. There's all these challenges and assistance. I mean, it's all right there in the first three paragraphs. And it's kind of interesting in this you know, original single column book. That's all you have on the first page is just those three paragraphs. Fits precisely on the first page. And if you just think about it, if you had nothing else but this one page, what do you have? You've got. Remember what Jesus tried to teach you? That you have a universal father, a spiritual father. Okay? Yeah, strengthen that. And remember how you've read in the Bible, be you perfect? Yeah, strengthen that. And you may even remember something like, in my house there are many mansions. Okay. What are they doing here in these first three paragraphs? See, they're taking the fourth epical revelation, and they're giving you it in a solid three-paragraph, complete, you know, anchor. Your beginning is a nice little grip on the fourth epical revelation. Now, and if you could get every single person on the planet to know nothing but these three paragraphs, you've changed everything. You don't need anything else in the book. If you could just get them a real solid, non-kindergarten level, fourth epical revelation grip on reality, these three paragraphs. Yeah. So, you know, just a thought to consider, you know, as the Urantia movement goes forward. For those who really see their mission in life is to minister to those who really don't have the fourth epical revelation yet, or that have it... but it's kind of fuzzy and magical. It's like, well, if they're open, help them boil it all down. You know, all of their pre-fourth epical or their post-fourth epical confusion, boil it down to these three paragraphs. If you've got a cosmos and a God and a notion of yourself, three paragraphs, like this, now we can do something. But really, see, and the Divine Counselor is saying, if you can't stomach these three paragraphs, if you can't think of God as your Father, you live in a cosmos filled with inhabited worlds, and that cosmos has a purpose of being perfect, as the eternal Creator is perfect, then don't turn the page, you know?
That's the important thing, that they define it a little bit more. Be perfect in your own sphere.
Right. That actually is coming up in the rest of this section. Yeah. The rest of the section is going to go into those details. But the reason I stopped it there is, even if there's some things that you might get a little confused on with just these three paragraphs, I mean, if everyone knew there was a purpose... and they express that purpose as be you perfect even as I am perfect. Even if they got that muddled a little bit, what if everyone had that cliche even, you know? How much farther along would we be? Yeah. And that's a real point. You know, as we turn the page, now we're going to start to really clarify it. That thing's the first thing that they want to really clarify. You know, and we're going to have all kinds of stuff about the universe of the universe, what that means exactly, you know. But just the difference between the heaven of heavens and the universe of universes, that's just a huge transition. You know, it's not the mystical heaven of heavens. It's a factual universe of universes. Okay, so I don't want to, belabor that to death. But I wanted to really stress, just for you to notice that, you know, that's how it starts. And it's very purposeful that he boiled everything that if he wanted you to get nothing else, you'd get what's in the first three paragraphs. Okay? God, the cosmos, and you. Okay?
Wonderful. I just wanted to emphasize the love and mercy of the paradise beings to help with this whole thing.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, and that's all in there. You know, you notice, you know, if we haven't tried to, you know, talk about, you know, for 10 minutes on every single sentence, you know, you guys all recognize what, you know, everything that's in there. You know, it's a pretty solid thing. It's got something that everyone who's ready for a little bit solider picture can grab a hold of. You know, there's love there, there's mercy, ministry, it's all there. And it's all in just these nice little three paragraphs.
You mentioned when we went through the Melchizedek, how Machiavenna first introduced himself. Mm-hmm. I am the God of the Most High.
Right.
Which was the highest God the Jews could conceive of
right.
at the time.
Right, that had been revealed to them.
Right. The pre-Jews.
I came from that God, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Are we spending far too much time trying to soft pedal and bootleg people into other parts of the book and maybe...
Well... let me just make one little quick comment on that. The way to avoid getting into that murky waters of, you know, how much should I water it down? How much should I backpedal? How circumspect should I be? Most likely, if you're having thoughts like that, you're trying to answer a question that's not being asked. You know, and so you're going into this ruminations and, you know, look for someone who's asking a question. If they're not uncomfortable with the answers they already have to the basic questions about God, the universe, and life, then what do you think you're going to do? I mean, you're going to do the non-Jesusonian thing, rip into their skull, rip out what little things they have and cram something else in? Is that what the life and teachings of Jesus taught you? No, of course not. I grind it out of him. Right. I mean, if they're not dissatisfied with where they are, move until find someone who's dissatisfied. And when you find that someone who's dissatisfied, do you go all mushy? No. You tell them the truth directly. Because they're looking for the truth. They don't want you to beat around the bush. They want you to tell you. You know, they want you to tell them what they're looking for. And of course, you're willing to open your mouth in the midst of that openness because you're not going to fill them with, well, I've got a rationalization scheme for you. No, you've got the fifth ethical revelation. Jesus never argued about the fatherhood of God or the brotherhood of man. You know, in other words, he just never went into that whole go nowhere space. You know? All right. Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to just, you know, because it starts just rolling, you know. We'll read many, many paragraphs at a time as we get going in this, you know, unlike the foreword. Because it's not meant to be so dense. Those first three paragraphs warranted some, you know, serious consideration just to see how he's wanting us to start. And that should help us going forward too. Just keep that in mind. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. That was paragraph one. Okay? You know? And then there's a cosmos with inhabited creatures and you've all been encouraged and given what you need to respond to the mandate of be you perfect. And that's all you really need. Okay, now that salvation issue, you know, and all of its kind of immediate consequences and circumstances are dealt with. Now, okay, let's move on. We're done with salvation now. Now let's think about reality. And let's think about what kind of a cosmos we're a cosmic citizen in. We're not going to worry about salvation anymore.
The animal origin dude that could.
Yeah. Is going to now. Yeah. All right.
This magnificent and universal injunction to strive for the attainment of the perfection of divinity is the first duty and should be the highest ambition of all the struggling creature creation of the God of perfection. This possibility of the attainment of divine perfection is the final and certain destiny of all man's eternal spiritual progress. Urantia mortals can hardly hope to be perfect in the infinite sense, but it is entirely possible for human beings, starting out as they do on this planet, to attain the supernal and divine goal which the infinite God has set for mortal man. And when they do achieve this destiny, they will, in all that pertains to self-realization and mind attainment, be just as replete in their sphere of divine perfection as God himself is in his sphere of infinity and eternity. Such perfection may not be universal in the material sense, unlimited in intellectual grasp, or final in spiritual experience, but it is final and complete in all finite aspects of divinity of will, perfection of personality motivation, and God consciousness.
Okay, there's a couple of things we want to notice in there, because we remind ourselves we're not just beginning readers. Let's notice a couple of little details in there. We talk about how it's a twofold consecration. Notice it being expressed there in the middle of that paragraph. In all that pertains to self-realization and mind attainment. Nice. Self-realization, the end point of that, consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. You know, that pattern, that spirit pattern, that personality, that purposing potential is how you take something from an actuality to a reality, how you realize it. You realize that self. Make that actuality of that self a reality, self-realization. You know, get it all firmly grasped by the God hand that was given to you. And mind attainment, consecrating your mind to the cosmic harmony of God the Mother. We know that in this mode, I mean, basically most of the time when they're using just God, you know, they're saying God the Father, like they told you up in the foreword that that's what they often are doing. So they don't have to repeat God the Father over and over and over and over again. Okay? But we know there's something else coming in here. And then think about how that ends. So you're thinking about those two sides of the equation, and you have all finite aspects of divinity of will, perfection of personality motivation. It's like, well, that's reminding me of the Father part and God conscious. Well, I mean, I've always thought that was just consciousness of God the Father. But we'll see. Wait a minute. There's got to be, you know, there's two things up there. And those two seem very much kind of on the one side, even on an initial look. God consciousness must be a little bit more than I've tended to think of it. Remember we pointed that out. That was what happened right at the end of the foreword. They gave that definition of God consciousness, and it had all kinds of words in it. You know, it didn't just say recognition of the Father. It said the spiritual appropriation of all truth contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience. God consciousness. And I can notice as a more sophisticated reader now, oh, ever progressing. You have adapting life, progressing mind, perfecting spirit, progressing. That's mind. That's a mind word. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when we pointed that out, you know, when we read that at the end of last week, you know, to begin to think of God consciousness in a more holistic way, you know, that it's not just some sort of a linear little line to the Father. You're talking about wrapping yourself around the whole picture you know, that needs all those words to describe. And so there's more than God the Father consciousness being pointed to there. There's God the Mother consciousness also. So that's a simple example of, you know, now that I've kind of keyed you to look for pairs of things within, separated by the conjunction and, you know, don't, you make sure that, you know, if they invoke both sides and you can see they're doing it, make sure you understand how that fits into the rest of the paragraph. It's like, well, it looks like they just mentioned in passing and then they forgot about it. You know, they didn't do that. You know, understand the whole paragraph at least in the context of that direct invocation of the twofold consecration. And the, you know, and the immediate thing, an avenue for something besides the Father is that expression, God consciousness. Because it, you know, it isn't sort of forcing you to talk about personality, will, you know, like the other two expressions are. All right.
This is the true meaning of that divine command, be you perfect, even as I am perfect, which ever urges mortal man onward and beckons him inward in that long and fascinating struggle for the attainment of higher and higher levels of spiritual values and true universe meanings. This sublime search for the God of universes is the supreme adventure of the inhabitants of all the worlds of time and space.
Yeah, nice little bit of poetry, but there's the word supreme in there. It's just a supreme adventure they're talking about here. Notice that they've used the word fascinating twice. It's a fascinating struggle. They said it twice in this preface to Faber 1. You know? If you didn't pick up on the first time, they said it again so that you go, wait a minute, when have I ever called a struggle fascinating? I hate struggles. I try to avoid them. I seek salubrious climbs. I thought that was the purpose of life, was ease. And that God, you know, if there's a God, he's a God of ease providing. That's all subtly in between the lines there. If you need to be able to start to think about a struggle as fascinating, effort, struggle, conflict come before faith. True faith lies, as an invocation, as a consequence, in the, you know, when you've taken your effort into struggle and into full-blown conflict. Now you know where God fits in. Okay, God doesn't fit in before effort, you know, struggle and conflict. He comes in after it. And so he's, you know, though that ministry that Terry mentioned was invoked there, yeah, we all know what kind of ministry that is. Seldom if you say, please, ministers, lead me towards God. Well, you say, do you realize that, you know, that faith thing lies, is the fourth word in the sequence. You know what you're asking for? You're asking for effort, struggle, conflict. You know, if you're not ready for that yet, don't ask. Careful what you ask for.
Okay. You think those that feast on uncertainty, fatten on disappointment, and enthuse in the face of apparent defeat, or find their struggles fascinating?
Right. It's like, oh, this is a cool struggle. Man, look at the potential in that one. That's a potential I've never been faced with before. When I figure out how to work through this, I'm going to come out the other side so much bigger than I am now. Fascinating, as Spock would say. It's fun to just spend a little time, see, on that first, before you can get to the first section. There's just all kinds of cool little things woven in that. And you know, spend some time yourself. I mean, you'll notice there's a whole bunch more that I didn't even bring up. There's all kinds of cool little things that they've stuck in there. All right, let's read some more. Go ahead. You need more than the preface. Yeah.
The Father's name. Of all the names by which God the Father is known throughout the universes, those which designate him as the first source and the universe center are most often encountered. The first father is known by various names in different universes and in different sectors of the same universe. The names which the creature assigns to the creator are much dependent upon the creature's concept of the creator. The first source and universe center has never revealed himself by name, only by nature. If we believe that we are the children of this creator, it is only natural that we should eventually call him Father. But this is the name of our own choosing, and it grows out of the recognition of our personal relationship with the first source and center.
Notice before that last one, first source and center, like it so often is, they purposely gave it to you, broken apart, so that at some point you might think, you know, maybe I could think about those as two things instead of one thing. Maybe there's some truth to it that I'll eventually discover is of it being one thing. But if I start with thinking of it as a first center on the one hand and a first source on another hand, maybe I'll discover a greater truth about what you mean by first source and center if you bottle those two things together. And that's beyond the level of this you know Friday night class. But that's something, see, that can be pursued. And again, just noticing that they didn't let the book go very far before they gave it to you as two separate things, just to tease that. You know. All right. Oh, yeah?
So this last sentence about mm-hmm. the personal relationship with first source and center.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that it can become personal with us is to look upon God as a father, because if it was mm-hmm. just the first source and center, wouldn't it be kind of like Buddhism or something?
Yeah, very good point. So think about that. If I'm here, where I'm being directly engaged by the sevenfold, that downstep stairway from the infinite and the eternal down to me, as I look back, I look up to the circuit of the Father and I start looking back to its roots, you know, I see the universal Father here, that very definite personal circuit point that I see as a person. And so, this is exactly what you're saying. I mean, if you think about, okay, well, my first thought conceptually is if I'm really, you know, by insight, you know, contemplating the first source and center, I'm really, in any sort of recognizable personal way, I'm not really seeing them. I'm seeing the personal face in front of, you know, between that and me. I'm seeing the universal Father. And so that's, it's at that level that you would initially want to understand that statement. You can take it to a higher level when you begin to develop this and you begin to understand the subtleties of what the meaning of the term God the Infinite is and how that term God the Infinite is really more directly tied to the first source and center part of the Father than it is to the universal Father, the universal Creator, you know, the other parts. And, you know, that it's not just a fuzzy word. It has some specificity to it, just like everything does. You know, so it's, you're not distorting by saying God the Infinite, personalization of deity. Okay. So in a higher sense that we don't need to go into in the details right now, there's a personal relationship with the first source and center too. But that's sort of transcendent of a relationship with the universal Father. That's a really high, high concept. Okay, start a little bit closer to home with, you know, you think of that personal face of the first source and center being the universal Father. Not trying to somehow, you know, get some sort of a omnipersonal thing behind that. Okay, because that's what it more technically is. It's more omnipersonal behind the universal Father.
The universal Father never imposes any form of arbitrary recognition, formal worship, or slavish service upon the intelligent will creatures of the universes. The evolutionary inhabitants of the worlds of time and space must of themselves, in their own hearts, recognize, love, and voluntarily worship him. The Creator refuses to coerce or compel the submission of the spiritual free wills of His material creatures. The affectionate dedication of the human will to the doing of the Father's will is man's choicest gift to God. In fact, such a consecration of creature will constitutes man's only possible gift of true value to the Paradise Father. In God, man lives, moves, and has his being. There is nothing which man can give to God except this choosing to abide by the Father's will, and such decisions, effected by the intelligent will creatures of the universes, constitute the reality of that true worship which is so satisfying to the love-dominated nature of the Creator Father.
I have to just point two little things out in there. Just to further encourage you to look at the etymologies of words, to draw more visual images out of a paragraph. Because, you know, we've all lost this. This is not really taught us anymore. Coerce or compel. You probably tend to kind of blur those two words together. Okay? Yeah, or, there's an or, and they're really separate in this sense. Okay? So visually, what's the difference? Coerce is, you're standing here, and here comes God's hands. Okay, just try to do something else now. Okay? Coerce is when you're surrounded by confining hands. That's what coerce means. Okay? Compel is push. So he doesn't put you in so small a space that you have no choice, and he doesn't shove you with absolute hands that you have no choice, you know, but to obey. He doesn't do either of those. Yeah. So just, you know, to see that, see that visually, that sentence visually a little bit more. And now also, you know, notice in between the lines. You know, everyone remembers this, you know, who's read the book for any length of time. In fact, such a consecration, okay, we're talking about the consecration of will, but we know that's only one of the two consecrations. Such a consecration of creature will constitutes man's only possible gift of true value to God? Oops. Just so you couldn't possibly blur it all together. You know, they say God, 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 God. And in that particular spot, they specifically said Father. You know, the consecration of your will is the only thing you can give to the Father. But that, there's more to it than that. I can give my consecration, the consecration of my mind, to the Mother. Yeah. But see, specifically to the Father, which is what this paper is about, Universal Father. But just notice the care, how careful they are. You know, they didn't even leave it to sort of your recognition. Like, well, I know that here when they say God, that, you know, like they told me in the foreword, I should replace that by God the Father for specificity. But they don't want you to get into this mode that so many people get into. It's like, well, all there is the consecration of my will. My mind is irrelevant. No, it's not. It's the other half of the picture.
Danger.
Right. You know, and we all know how dangerous it can be to have a muddle mind with an absolute consecration. You want to talk about compel, you know, do you really want to push that thing into absoluteness? That muddled mess of a cacophony mind? No, you don't. Don't even think about, you know, remember he gave, you know, he doesn't coerce or compel, but he gave that ability to you. You can coerce and compel yourself. So don't cast your pearls before swine. Don't coerce and compel a muddle mind. Don't do it. Danger, danger, like Chris was saying. just little things in there.
What's a muddle mind?
Oh, just it's all muddled up. It's like you always talk about the choppy seas of your agitant mind. It's all subjective. It's blown about by the winds. It's all a muddle. It's all churned up into a froth. Right? There's no placid, you know, lake with the Grand Teton reflecting off of it or anything like that. You know, that's the Holy Spirit. That's the temple within, you know, when it's that placid sea. That, if you can get there, now, okay, apply a little push. But don't push the choppy seas. That's when it's not about the absolute. That's when it's absolute-ism. See, that's there is an absolute, but it's absolute-ism when you try to make that which has no relationship to the absolute absolute. Your subjective mind. Okay. The absolute mind has a direct connection to the absolute, but not the subjective mind.
Talk about blowing away all that has gone before. The consideration of mind in this context. And they didn't waste any time. They got you, like you said, they got the fourth part done. Mm-hmm. And now let's get fifth about it.
Right. If you're noticing more than half the words. You know, if you just noticed half the words in these sentences, all you'd see is half of the picture, see? You know? Notice when there's an and then there's another half. Yep.
When you have once become truly God-conscious, after you really discover the majestic Creator and begin to experience the realization of the indwelling presence of the Divine Controller, then, in accordance with your enlightenment and in accordance with the manner and method by which the Divine Sons reveal God, you will find a name for the Universal Father which will be adequately expressive of your concept of the first great source and center. And so, on different worlds and in various universes, the Creator becomes known by numerous appellations. In spirit of relationship, all meaning the same, but in words and symbols, each name standing for the degree, the depth of His enthronement in the hearts of His creatures of any given realm.
Did you notice how that paragraph started? How they were putting filters there? They're not going to let you in with the muddle mind? You have once become, once become truly God conscious, after you really discover the majestic Creator and begin to experience the realization of the indwelling presence of the Divine Adjuster, Divine Changer, Divine Controller, okay? They're really trying to encourage you to not go running, like I was saying, don't go running off with this initial fuzzy thought you've got in your head as a little child of God and start absolutizing it. If you can get up to the point where you think you're not only truly, but also really, and what's the difference between truly and really? I don't know. Well, then you haven't made it through this first part of the sentence, okay? You know, and then what's the difference between a thought adjuster and a thought controller? And they're really putting some buffer between you and the open freedom. It's like, well, I define God. You get to this latter part and you're thinking, wow, it's all about me. Whatever I say is, I define God. I name Him and He is that. You notice how it kind of is opening. That's why they put such a filter on the front of it, see. All right.
But for me.
I think, and He is.
I have one more question about that. So, our world sees the Father, the Spirit, and the Son. The Father, Son, and Spirit. The Father, Spirit, and Son. But other worlds, they could see the Spirit and the Son. That would be their sevenfold God. So are we like the ones that have the Father, Son, and Spirit? We see it all three.
Look, I'm not going to. They talk about that. That's what's coming up next. Just look at how they invoke that sort of thinking. Okay. You're right, spot on. That's what they want you to start thinking. Is, well, gee, what would alter the way that someone thought about it? So let's just look. Let's just look at how it goes.
Near the center of the universe of universes, the Universal Father is generally known by names which may be regarded as meaning the first source. Farther out in the universes of space, the terms employed to designate the Universal Father more often mean the Universal Center. Still farther out in the starry creation, He is known as on the headquarters world of your local universe, as the first creative source and divine center. In one nearby constellation, God is called the Father of Universes, in another, the Infinite Upholder, and to the east, the Divine Controller. He has also been designated the Father of Lights, the Gift of Life, and the All-Powerful One.
Okay. Lots of fun things you can contemplate, but just notice the one very linear thing in there that they're wanting you to do. So you're starting at the core and backing out, and the perspective is changing. So you're down there in Havona, you know, and you're just immersed in it, the first source. I mean, you're so close that you don't even think of a center point. You're just immersed in the first source. And they say you back out a little ways, and then you start to think, like, okay, we've got the whole coordinate system here, and here's the center of the coordinate system. And so, you know, the first center, you know, or the universal center comes into play. And then you back out a little bit more, and, okay, well, now we're actually thinking about both. There's a source and a center. Yeah, so just, you know, just notice that. That's just a little bit of a directional, you know, or distance sort of perspective. You know, the constellation Fathers, you know, in the constellation world, so it's the Father of Universes. The word Father comes in there. The one fun one there is, to the east, the Divine Controller. Why on earth do they throw in east? Okay. Do they mean, like, you know, over in Asia? No, of course not. Think about it, you know, think about what we haven't studied yet, but, you know, it's coming up. If you've got the whole seven super universes cosmology laid out in front of you here, you know, okay, here's the seventh super universe, you know, swinging around the bottom, starting to head north along the big ellipse, yeah, and we're on the outside here, pretty much, you know, we're to look towards the center of all things, you have to look across the galaxy, and we're sort of on the outside part, not too many things outside of us in the super universe, but if I look to the east, I'm looking even more out from where I already am, quite out. I'm getting farther and farther away from the personal core of things. It's being less and less creator in the way you relate, and more controller, more and more power, not so much personal.
Yeah, and sure enough.
See? And so that's what they call him, the Divine Controller. You know, they're out there where, you know, they're just really thankful that there's someone in control of this kind of wild and woolly far east, you know, in this case, you know, where things are not very settled yet, and they think a lot about the controller. Thank God for God as the universal controller and all of his downstepped hands of controllers, all those master physical controllers and power centers that are keeping this under control a bit, so that I, you know, I'm not blasted to smithereens by some rogue phenomenon. Yes, yeah, it's all right there. See?
In addition to this divine controller, like you were saying,
mm-hmm.
it's more of a mind function as opposed to a more creative spirit function, maybe. I don't know.
Right, just again, you know, just the whole point is just notice how you're backing away a bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be much more immediate thought is the Almighty Supreme, you know, and some exaltation of the Almighty Supreme to the infinite level, you know, and you know, what happens if I really am aware of the Almighty Supreme in my finite surroundings, and I follow that up to what's at the highest level? What words do I come across? I don't find the Universal Father above that. I find the Universal Controller above that. Yeah, that's. Yeah. So it's just very natural. They're just trying to give you some examples of what they were saying. I mean, you are going to name God based upon your initial bottom-up viewpoint. It's not just us. We don't just do that because of the rebellion and the default and we're on a benighted sphere. Everyone does that. You can't do anything else. You have an initial bottom-up viewpoint. You give God the exaltation of your bottom-up viewpoint picture on reality. Yeah, you know, even in Havona, they're telling you that's what they do, and they look at the bottom up, and it's like, wow, it's just like I'm just immersed in Source. You know, they're at the center. Okay, so I mean, you know,
on those worlds where a paradise son has lived a bestowal life, God is generally known by some name indicative of personal relationship, tender affection, and fatherly devotion. On your constellation headquarters, God is referred to as the Universal Father, and on different planets in your local system of inhabited worlds, he is variously known as the Father of Fathers, the Paradise Father, the Havona Father, and the Spirit Father. Those who know God through the revelations of the bestowals of the Paradise Sons eventually yield to the sentimental appeal of the touching relationship of the Creature-Creator Association and refer to God as our Father.
Again, you got a nice list. Just pick a couple to think about. So, in your local system, okay, so that's getting pretty close to home. In your local system, and we know everything is, you know, heavy-duty Father because of the seventh bestowal, and that's pretty, should be pretty obvious why it's Father everywhere, okay? But notice some of the adjectives. In your local system, you have Paradise Father, Havona Father. Oh, yeah, that's right, of course. There's planets in our local system that have had, you know, the nature of God revealed all the way up to the Paradise level. They know about Havona and Paradise, and they would, you know, put those in the designation. You know, we can do that now too because we've been had Paradise and Havona revealed to us. But if you go off in the local system to one of the non-rebellion worlds, some world that's been around quite a long time, and but maybe they've only had it revealed up to the local universe level. You know, maybe they haven't gotten Trinity, Teacher, Son yet. Maybe they don't have it all the way up to Havona. You know, or whatnot, you know. That's between the lines of statements like that, you know. It's something that humans have just never really contemplated until they revealed to us this whole very methodical, normal order of things that they only reveal up to the constellation level within its Adam and Eve. You know, and then the magisterial son only reveals up to the local universe level. And then the bestowal son only reveals up to the super universe level. You know, and those on those worlds that have had a bestowal son, and it's all in that very, sort of minimalized, if you will, and controlled process of growing a world, they're not going to say Paradise Father. Or Havona Father. That's not how they're going to think about the Father. And just think about how different that would be. I mean, see, that's another little wild card of our bestowal son. He already knew everything was sort of being thrown out the window when he jumped over the magisterial son. So he was speaking a little bit more freely about the picture than a normal bestowal son would. And normally the bestowal son only reveals up to the super universe fathers, the ancients of days. And it's like, wow. I mean, you know, that's hard for us to really, you know, we've been so let loose by the Lucifer rebellion. Every time we even are exposed to the notion of someone, you know, holding back from us or something, you know, we really bristle at that. How dare they? Who are they to think that they cannot tell me about Havona? I don't care if he's a Paradise son. Just notice how there's some tension there immediately with that. You know, it's just a fun thing to think about. That's, we only have that sort of thought because of Kalyastia. You know, if you hadn't had that, we would have all been kept very happy in a much smaller space and moved along to prevent us from having undue spiritual tension when we're not ready to deal with it. But, you know, he throws the gates wide open. And so now we have, as really immature children of God, we have to try to deal with massive spiritual tensions in our lives that normally you're shielded from by your parents, you know, who are guiding you along very wisely, only giving you what you can really handle at any point. You know, for these 100,000 years, we're only going to tell you this.
So why is it you think that they gave us so much?
See, again, that's what you have. You know, I'm just trying to re-stress that question, getting everyone to ask that question. Just what does that mean? Why, when we had so little, did they give us so much? Did Michael start the process and give us so much? And now this just doubles down, giving us so much. Giving us so much that we could abuse. I mean, there are so many things in here that humans could just create, you know, an orgy of darkness and death with, if, you know, going off on an ignorant tangent with. I mean, there's so many things to misunderstand in here.
Well, they do. Just look at Martin
Gardner. It's huge. So, yeah.
Maybe it's the go ahead, drink the cup.
Yeah. It's a real, it seems to be, I mean, you know, obviously you can talk about this forever, but if nothing else, it's obvious that what you're just saying is being put into play. Normally, you're kind of sheltered from how binary reality is, that there's no middle ground reality. There's reality and nothing, and that's all there is. It's like right in our face now. I mean, it's so easy now that everything has been opened up to go to the nothing. And it's so clear that the something is something in face of that nothing. You know, if you can see any distance down the two paths, it's so obvious. You know, when you can only see to the constellation level, it's hard to see oblivion. You know, it's hard to take it to infinity and eternity, you know. But boy, once you can see all the way, it should be obvious to those who have eyes to see and ears to hear that if you take that track, that goes nowhere you want to go. Just look at all the way down the line. Don't stare, you know, at your feet. Lift your chin up and look down that line. You don't want to go down that line. You can see all the way down there now. Beyond there be dragons. Don't go down there.
It's just a very extraordinary, when you look at the panoply of potential, this, my God.
One might even say fascinating.
Yeah.
See? Yeah, it just really, I mean, you start to notice, it's like, you know, that's a good word. When you start to really think about what's in play, fascinating. Fascinating that he would do that. You know he's not made a mistake. Fascinating. What exactly is in play? You know, really getting you think. You know, getting you thinking about it. All right, well, let's wrap up this last little paragraph here.
On a planet of sex creatures, in a world where the impulses of parental emotion are inherent in the hearts of its intelligent beings, the term father becomes a very expressive and appropriate name for the eternal God. He is best known, most universally acknowledged on your planet, Urantia, by the name God. The name he is given is of little importance. The significant thing is that you should know him and aspire to be like him. Your prophets of old truly called him the everlasting God and referred to him as the one who inhabits eternity.
Prophets like Isaiah, amongst others. But did that get you to notice something you may have not thought about before? So he is best known, most universally acknowledged on your planet, Urantia, by the name God. You know, in the midst of, you know, divine center and all these things. Well, I thought God was just like, you know, a nothing word. That doesn't mean anything. It's just the word God. Well, you know it means something. It's got an etymology. What is it? What should have gotten you think, gee, I never thought about it. What does the word God mean? When I call him God, what do I mean?
It's quite a unique word.
It's a very little word. I mean, it has a literal meaning. I mean, the most straightforward way to express its literal meaning is, it means, you know, it's capital G, so there's a the in front of what it means. It's, you know, to call him God is to call him the initiator.
Wow. Huh.
That's what that literally means. So think about that. So back here, when they said, the truth about the universal father had begun to dawn upon mankind. You know, that whole notion, you know, and bringing in the father. So we have this very ubiquitous word, like they're saying here, of God. What's the recognition behind that? That almost universal usage of that. We're recognizing the initiator. You know, can call him many things, infinite upholder, whatnot, but they're reminding you that you already have the root. So go back to those first two sentences, and remember there's some copies up there. The thing I did where I created the parallel with God the Father and God the Mother. This is the God the Father pair of words, or pair of sentences. And I created a parallel set for God the Mother. The universal Father is the God of all creation. The first source and center, the initiator of all things and beings. First think of him as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. I inserted that, the initiator, in there. Because that's the most universal way to begin to understand how God the Father fits into the picture when you have more than God the Father. When you have God the Son, God the Spirit, God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute, even God the Mother, God the Sevenfold, on and on it goes. Okay, it's like, oh my gosh, this is so confusing. Do I even know what God the Father is anymore? Yes, you do. What's the literal meaning of the word God? The initiator. That's God the Father. You know that God. You know that God very well. You know him so well, you've forgotten that that's the only name that you normally use for him, is the initiator. You know that God. Okay. So let's wrap it up there tonight. We got the ball rolling here, I think, pretty well.
I have a dying question.
Yeah, one little thing to throw in there before we...
Does God have a face?
Yes.
Okay, does it say so in the papers we're going to read?
He has a face. Like you heard me say tonight, the first name to give to that face, in the sense that you're thinking of, face, call that face the Universal Father. And those other five facets, call that his body. Call the Universal Father the face.
But literally, does he have...
Yeah, one step at a time, one step at a time. Okay. Okay, so let's start with that. You've heard me use the term, that there are six facets of God the Father. Facet. Face, okay, it's the same word, okay. I am actually saying that now technically there's six faces, okay, but there's one face in the sense that you're speaking of most directly, a personal face, a face with eyes, nose, that thing that you can look into the eyes of, that's what you're wondering, okay. Now of course, you don't want to get anthropomorphic about this, and I don't want to talk about that too much because that's the next section. We'll talk about that next time. But definitely, you want to not let go of that notion that a being needs to have a face. Now, what you have to do, add to that, when you're talking about the face of God the Father, is you have to remember what you've heard me say many times. When God the Father looks at you, and when you look at God the Father, you're looking face to face, yes. But that face is absolutely only the face that you can see. Remember, his relationship to you is absolute, not relative. In other words, you don't share your relationship with anyone else. You have an absolutely independent relationship with God the Father. There is a face. So think about that face of God. It's actually an infinite number of faces with eyes and nose and mouth and eyes that you can look into. And one of those infinite number of faces is just for you. The eternal Son cannot see those eyes. He cannot look into those Father's eyes. Only you can. I can't. John can't. Chris can't. The Infinite Spirit can't. The Consummator of Universal Destiny can't. No other person can look in those eyes except you. Because his relationship with you is absolute. Okay? So, yes, he has a face, but not in a simple anthropomorphic way where everyone walks up and looks in the same pair of eyes. And it's a face that, in spite of the fact that he resides at infinity and eternity, that you can see right now. Because you've been given eyes to see, personality, see in this way, and you've been given a means to see with those eyes, those personality eyes, the third cosmic intuition, the first conduit, the first link into the cosmos. And that link goes all the way. If you look through that viewpoint, you know, if you look into the cosmos through with your personality eyes, through that means of seeing, through that mechanism of insight, you will see the face of God, your face, one just for you. And to not let that be a metaphor. It's literal. You know, that's what we're coming up on the reality of God, sees the next section. If there's a reality to God, if God's a being, then I have to be able to think about it literally like this. You know, not kindergarten, not simplistically, but literally, yes. Yeah. So you will look into his eyes when you're standing on the aisle. But I won't look into those eyes. And you can begin to look in those eyes now. But imagine how much more deeply into those eyes you'll see when you're standing in front of him than what you can see now. Right now you just see the surface of his eyes. There you will see deeply. You will see to the full finite depth of his eyes. You'll penetrate to supremacy in his eyes. Yeah.
When you get to that point where you're actually standing face to face to look at God, you would have fused. You would
long,
have
long ago.
Long, long ago. I often imagine that the face that God would see in me, mm-hmm. and that I would see in God would almost be mirror images.
You're right. Because you'll be godlike. You'll be a reflection. He wants you to be something that he can see. And when you're something that he can see, guess what? He's something that you can see. And that's the only way that you can see each other. We're about to read that too. That's coming up. I mean, you know, in a very much more direct, literal way, like you're going to be doing when you're standing on the aisle, you can't do that yet. You know, if you stand there, you don't see anything. You don't have eyes to see that yet. You have to be able to see at the infinite eternal level to see him there. He's infinitely above where you are right now. You know, so you see down here. You got to get yourself up there where you can see where he is. You're seeing downstepped expressions of him right now. And that's why I'm saying, I mean, if you think about it in sort of a metaphor, I mean, when you look into his eyes now, you're just seeing those downstepped eyes. You're sort of just seeing the surface. You're not seeing as any depth yet.
It seems the face of Jesus was the face of God with eyes, nose, mouth, etc.
Well, very good point. Yeah, right. If you want to take it to that, yeah. You know, the Word made flesh. He who has seen me has seen the Father. So if you wanted to ask the question, well, okay, not in metaphorical terms, but literally, if you take those downstepped eyes of the universal Father and you had them in front of you, what would they look like? They look like Jesus' eyes. But, I'm just trying to make it, you know, again, when Jesus said that, he wasn't being metaphorical, you know.
He was seeing me as seeing literally, the Father.
Literally, he was seeing me as seeing the Father.
So
if you become, you know, intuitively connected to the life and teachings of Jesus, like Terry is saying, now take what you know and put it literally in front of you. Put those eyes in front of you that you now have synchronized with. And what do you see? Now you're seeing the Father as the Father looks when he's downstepped into the flesh.
When we think about our relationship with our Heavenly Father, that that is really the most significant, the most intimate, the most important of all relationships, because all our other relationships are going to, at least, will be temporarily separated from. I mean, we're told that we will.
Yeah, and it's first, always, and last, because no matter where you are, whether or not you're at the very beginning or anywhere in the middle, even all the way at the end, in order to take a step, you have to be initiated. A first step, a hundredth step, a trillionth step. That's why when all is said and done. I mean, you need the initiator to initiate you. It's the primal God, because it's God the initiator. I mean, it's not that the other gods, you know, aren't just as important in the big picture. But, you know, if I haven't been initiated, what good does it have for me to have God the Mother to connect me with someone else? For that matter, what if there's not another person that's been initiated? Then God the Mother can't connect me to another person, because I'm the only person, the only real person. I mean, without the Father, you know... there's no place for everything else. There has to be an initiator. That's why he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. He alone pulls himself out. God, the everything else, is within. He pulls himself out because he's going to initiate everything. He has to be outside in order to initiate what the inside is going to be. I mean, he even is initiating inside this, obviously, by pulling himself out. Until he pulls himself, there is no inside. There's no inside or outside. You know, he creates outside and inside when he frees himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. And that initiates everything else. What initiates God the Mother? The Paradise Trinity and the Infinite Upholder. You know? Well, what initiated them? Well, you take it all the way back. I mean, it all goes back. So it all is rooted in the roots of the Father, the first source and center. You know, and that initiating. And the personal face of that initiating is called the Universal Father.
So we'll kind of go out with our own destinies like Jesus had. I mean, we won't be a creator son, but we'll be a son.
We'll have a very definitive new reconsecrated purpose. When we leave as a finaliter, you're sort of repurposed. We've talked about that. There's two phases. There's an initial phase between here and paradise, and then you're repurposed, you know, for the next stage. And you go out, you know, your purpose is not to seek God the Father. You've done that. So you have to be repurposed, you know. Now you're going to be seeking God the Supreme. But again, I noticed as you were saying that reflection. Remember, you're only reflecting that facet of the Father that's tied to you. You know, I'm not going to reflect your facet. I'm not going to reflect the totality of God the Father. I'm not going to have God the Fatherness in totality. I'm going to have one little facet of God the Father likeness, you know, okay. Just, you know, but it's, you know, it may not be infinite in extent, but it's infinite in intent. That linkage to that measure of the Father is intended to take me all the way to eternity, and it will. And I don't have to be infinite in extent to get to eternity.
So we'll be like this beautiful little fragment of God that's going around in the universe
doing things that we can't even imagine yet. Right. Yeah. You'll be you'll be really close. I mean, you know, remember, you're going to have a real closeness with that Father fragment at that point. You're so close that, you know, your direct adjutants are the gravity messengers. And, I mean, you got some serious top level, you know, functioning as these little facets, these, you know, those little expressions of God going on when you're a finaliter. Yeah. All right. Well, let's spend a little moment, reflect on that, and we'll pick up on the reality of God next time.